I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Ian McEwan is the author of 19 novels, some of which have been adapted to film, like On Chesil Beach and Atonement. His latest novel, What We Can Know, is set 100 years in the future and focuses on a biographer's attempt to locate a poem that was written about by people who heard it recited by the author, a poem that exists as a single copy, handwritten on vellum, and presented as a birthday gift. I had a chance to speak with Ian McEwan about What We Can Know, and here's our conversation. So What We Can Know is your 19th published novel, and it's set in two timelines, 100 years apart, and it revolves around an event referred to in the future timeline as the Second Immortal Dinner, described in the novel as even worse than the long-forgotten Bloomsbury obsession. Is this a good place to start to set up the book for our listeners?
Yes, sure. That's the only place, I'd say.
So what was the Second Immortal Dinner?
The Second Immortal Dinner, well, a very famous fictional poet called Francis Blundy. I'd say he was, you know, about as famous as Seamus Heaney was in his lifetime. He sets about writing a long sonnet sequence as a gift to his wife on her birthday, and he invites a few friends around to dinner, and he reads the poem to the nine people there, including his wife Vivian, and he's made absolutely sure that no other draft of this poem exists, and he's written it out in fair hand on a piece of vellum, which is in a kind of roll tied with a ribbon. And at the end of the poem, he presents it to her. And we do not know what happened to that poem. And it becomes rather famous because people around that table write about it, and succeeding generations begin to be so fascinated by its fate, why it vanished, why it wasn't published. And they project onto those blank pages their own aspirations and wishes and fears as the 21st century progresses. And this poem is the object of intense interest 100 years later of a young academic called Tom Metcalf, who is on the pursuit of this poem. He's absolutely certain it exists. And so in a sense, this novel is a kind of quest, but along the way, we get a history of the 21st century, the three-quarters of it we haven't yet experienced. And I'm not going to say much about the second timeline, but it, just to say that it's set in the present, and many of the things that Tom Metcalf tries to understand over the distance of years, we get another angle on. And so its central issue is what we can know about history, what we can know about the future of history, too, and then what we can know about each other's, and finally, what we can know about ourselves, the limits of all these things.
In the future timeline of the novel, you mentioned Tom Metcalf. He's a biographer. He's obsessed with the poem. A Corona for Vivian is the name of it, and more specifically, with Vivian herself. I have a couple of questions about his efforts, but first, I'm wondering, could you explain to our listeners what a sonnet corona is?
Yes, okay. Well, it's a very elaborate form. It derives from either the Renaissance or slightly later. So there you are, you've got 15 sonnets. The last line of each sonnet has to be the first line of the next. Now, a sonnet, for those who do not know, is a poem with 14 lines. So when you get to the 15th sonnet, that is the crown, the corona. And that has to consist of the first line of all the preceding 14 sonnets. And it has to make jolly good sense. And the poem traditionally is addressed to one certain person, a loved one or a precious, significant person. It generally is written in what we call the Petrarchan form. I don't know if you really want me to go into that, but it's got a rhyming scheme. A-B-B-A, A-B-B-A, C-D-E, C-D-E. So it doesn't end with, you know, in Shakespeare's sonnets, there's a clinching couplet. very elaborate, difficult form, and the trick is to make it flow easily, as if the poet has had no problem with the constraints. So it's tricky. And, of course, you know, to sit at a table at this dinner, and they've drunk quite a lot. They've had two or three very strong gin and tonics. They're well into the 9th, 10th bottle of wine. And, of course, they're not all listening as closely as you can. And actually, given Francis Blundy's rather condensed style, listening to 15 sonnets is quite a demand on attention. So I enter the minds of all of those people around the table, the thing that life, you know, privilege that life doesn't offer you, but the novel does, can. And yet it gets known as the Second Immortal Dinner. The first Immortal Dinner was in 1817 on the 28th of December, when a painter, Benjamin Haydon, invited Keats and Wordsworth and the essayist Charles Lamb and a few others to his house and wrote it up 20 years later. His is the only account. He was an incredibly unreliable fellow. But anyway, he said it was evenings of amazing wit and wisdom and badinage and jolliness. So my point is, it's rather ironical, I suppose. The Second Immortal Dinner is nowhere near as witty and profound. Everyone's a little too tipsy. But still, there it goes. There's a journalist called it, sometime in the 21st century, the Second Immortal Dinner, to kind of sanctify it, and the name stuck.
I do have a couple of questions about Tom Metcalfe's methodology, I guess it would be. You know, first, we often hear of letters being burned to protect privacy, whether it be Jane Austen's or Charles Dickens. Yet in Tom Metcalfe's future, he has access to digital records. Items once encrypted are freely available to all. A quote in the book reads, "We have robbed the past of its privacy." And this was laid out toward the beginning of the novel.
Yep.
And it felt like a cautionary tale regarding climate change, yes, but also our current embracing of AI and all things digital, and trusting that privacy policies in the early aughts will be honored. Does this scare you?
Well, I'm not on social media, and I rarely commit anything significant, private, intimate, to emails. I think I've been aware of that for a very long time. And also, I mean, already we know that WhatsApp, end-to-end encryption on WhatsApp, has now been cracked by governments, and slightly more complex ones like Signal, they've also been cracked open, wide. So I imagine the future will read all our encrypted emails. But the bigger problem, I think, Beth, is that for the biographer especially, too much material. I mean, every day we might send, you know, 10, 12, 15 emails or texts or WhatsApps or whatever platform you're on, then endless social media. And then Tom's subject, the poet, given, you know, scores, hundreds, maybe even 1,000 interviews across a lifetime, every last lecture and interview like this, all available, a colossal avalanche of information. And picking your way through it might not get you to material that's wiser than biographers looking back to the 19th century get from the letters of Napoleon or Darwin or Dickens. So it seems to me an interesting problem, not discussed in science fiction that speculates a lot, very usefully, about the future. But what is the history of history? What is the history of biography? And then more broadly, what about the humanities? What can they know? What do they know? So I suppose, without wanting to put readers off, this is, in part, a set of love stories, too, but it's set against the background of, you know, epistemology. What can we know?
You know, the other thing about Tom is, while he had access to Francis and Vivian's digital footprint and journals, there was much he didn't know, and so he was prone to make assumptions and insert them into his writing as facts. You talk a little bit about this in your acknowledgments, and the epigraph of your novel touches on it also. Talk to me about the biographer's art and how Tom measures up.
Well, the first element is that intense involvement with your subject. They become, and I've spoken to a few biographers about this, they become sort of almost love objects. I mean, they're almost like friends, close friends, separated from you by this wall of time, a very frustrating wall of time. And in the writing, you might have a number of facts, but sometimes you just need to bring certain scenes to life. And the temptation to invent and to say what probably most likely happened, or this is what she most likely thought at this moment, becomes irresistible. Otherwise, biographers find that their pages are becoming very arid if you stick to, you know, just what the sources say. So it's a struggle that Tom has, and there's an ongoing discussion with his partner, who then becomes his wife. Her name is Rose. She's also an expert, probably even more established and brighter expert than Tom. And she's always telling him to stick to the facts. And he's always saying, but if I do that, my book will be just too dreary, too dry, too arid. So that's an ongoing contemplation throughout the novel. But then there are many things here that we know in daily life we cannot have. Like, we cannot know the thoughts of others, of course. And yet in the novel, if the novelist so chooses, we can have all the access we want. So, to come back to the second immortal dinner, I can go round the table from character to character and enter their thoughts. We take that as a fairly conventional and standard way of getting on, but it is highly unreal. So the title is also a reflection on my own writing process itself. Giving in a so-called realist novel access to other minds is a matter of immense artifice. And it's that paradox, too, that I'd like to explore.
I'm often amazed at how authors can create characters, invent lives, plot timelines, and keep everything straight. But you had to do this twice, you know, by imagining our future, inventing a new world. And I imagine your study looks like a war room or something. Do you have a method for keeping everything straight?
Yes, sometimes I draw a circle on the page, and around the perimeter of that circle, I might put the names of characters and the names of places they're in. And then what I end up with is a set of maybe four or five concentric circles. One circle for characters, one circle for time, one circle for place, with arrows or lines connecting all three. It looks like a terrible mess, but it does keep me more or less on track. Then, of course, if you have a very gifted line editor, as indeed I do, David Milner, he can come in with your final draft and see if he can pick holes in any of it. And usually there are a few holes to pick out and straighten out. But that process, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, it's just part of the daily business, but it's amazing if you've got 100 or 150,000 words and quite complex timelines, quite complex event lines, sooner or later you're going to get one or two things wrong. Saying something on page 33 that doesn't quite fit with someone's memory of it on page 506. And given that, you know, you might spend 2, 3, 4 years constructing this novel, there might be some, you know, tiny stone in the wall that shouldn't be there, inevitably. I find that process actually rather, it's immensely pleasing, the editorial process.
Can you talk to me about the references to Shakespeare in the novel? There were mentions of some of his characters, King Hamlet, Lady Macbeth, Othello, and Desdemona, but it was also pointed out that when it comes to biography, Shakespeare is a good example, because what do we actually know about him?
Yes, I mean, most of what we know about Shakespeare is when his lifeline, as it were, crosses some authority, or he sells something. Like, we know in the late 16th century that Shakespeare bought 80 tons of grain. Well, he was trying to make a quick buck, because there was a sort of almost like a famine in Warwickshire at the time, and he went in for a bit of hoarding. He tried to get his father a coat of arms towards the end of his life. So he was constantly... And then he was a lodger in a house in Silver Road, and he was an official witness to an agreement about the betrothal of two, the daughter with another man in his landlord's house. And then, of course, you know, the registering of his plays with, you know, the right authority and so on. What we don't know is something about his daily life. He left his wife behind in Stratford. Did he have lovers? Now there's a suggestion in Shakespeare studies that she was often in London with him, his wife. But we don't know a great deal about the man himself, what he was like. The habit of journal keeping was mostly limited to, you know, goings on in court. A playwright was a fairly lowly person. Printing, of course, was invented, but the author interview had to wait, you know, 200 or 300 years, really right into the mid-19th century, I'd say, had a guess. You know, and he didn't give readings. There weren't any newspaper profiles. And he didn't keep a diary, as far as we know. So a lot of speculation. Was he a Catholic, a closet Catholic? Was he an atheist? Did he ever travel to Poland, as once was suggested? And even, did he write those plays? It just goes on and on and on. And it's all this great edifice of Shakespeare studies stands on rather shaky and flimsy foundations. So my man, Tom, has the opposite problem. Too much information, masses of it. How much of it can he trust? But a lot of it trivial. You know, I'm on the plane. I'll see you at 11 o'clock. Whereas when you read the letters of Darwin or Napoleon, they're far more thoughtful, far more reflective. That letter is going to take 2 or 3 weeks to reach its destination, perhaps. They lived in slower times. I guess partly this novel, Beth, comes out of my love of science fiction, especially when it addresses the impact of some new technologies on civilization. But I thought there's some element of speculation about the future that could move away from technology and ask questions like, what is the future of history? What is the future of the humanities? Or indeed the future of love? There's quite a lot of love and there's quite a lot of betrayal in this novel, and somewhere in the center of it is a hidden, undiscussed crime that Tom knows nothing of, but we will. So the title never leaves me. It comes from a book by Richard Holmes, in which he thinks how biographer's relationship with his object is like a friendship. But the moment he publishes his biography, that's almost like a betrayal. And always the biographer or anyone thinking about the past is asking themselves, what can we know? And I guess my main interest was to look at the outer limits of what we can understand about others. We're so complicated, so mysterious, so contradictory, so endlessly baffling and intriguing that trying to build a full picture of someone else is almost like a lifetime's project, and you'll never get to know everything.
Francis Blundy thought that nearly all of life is forgotten. I'm not sure if yes. this is frightening or comforting.
Yeah, quite. It could be comforting on some aspects. But yes, I mean, sometimes someone says to me, how was your weekend? And they say it on a Tuesday morning, and I go blank for a bit. I think, the weekend? No, that was the weekend before. It's not only the facts that go from us or the feelings, but the sequence goes too. Sit round at, you know, Thanksgiving or Christmas dinners and everyone's talking about the past. And someone says, no, that was before I met you. Or, No, that movie came after the first one. So I don't think we're evolved to have intricate memories. Survival, I guess, was concentrating in the present. And memory is highly selective. A lot of work in the 20th century completely demolished the usefulness of police lineups, because it was shown that people's memories of what just happened is very, very partial and very, very scant. And you can have 30 people witness the same event and give unbelievably different accounts of it a week later. So I guess we have a whole literature that has flourished on the basis of not quite being able to enter the minds of others. And that's why I think the novel hasn't died. It can enter the minds of others for us in the way that movies cannot, or even stage drama cannot. In a sense, my title refers even to the very act of writing this novel itself.
Do you have a beef with the word hopefully?
No, none at all. But a lot of very literate friends of mine, I can name them, Christopher Hitchens, Martin, Amis, and we had this row in the past in a bar in New York, in fact, years ago. They were saying anyone who says hopefully is just a kind of ignorant fool. And I said, well, come on, it's basically a sentence adverb. You know, if you say sadly he died, sadly is not describing the way he died. Sadly refers to the attitude of the speaker of that sentence. Unfortunately, it will rain. Again, does not describe the way the raindrops fall. It describes an attitude, again, of the speaker or the writer. So there are many, many sentence adverbs, and hopefully simply says something about the mind attitude of the speaker. He hopes this to be true. Perfectly legitimate use of the word. It was invented by some kind of grammar maven in the 1920s, I think, and somehow it got some currency, and then educated speakers got intimidated because they think that other educated speakers would think they're ignorant fools. And so it became a kind of loop. Even if you knew that there was nothing wrong with it, you didn't use it because you were worried about what other people would think of you. So there you are, a wondrous piece of folly. And I thought, has anyone written about this? And yes, one of the best writers on this subject is Steven Pinker in his marvelous book of some years ago called The Language Instinct.
It was one of my favorite parts of the book. It made me smile. So do you have a hope for what readers will take away from this book?
Well, for a start, I hope they take away a lot of pleasure, really. I think that's the first duty of the novelist. I hope it will raise questions, not answers. I'm certainly not warning anyone about climate change because it's already here. No one needs a warning. Even so-called skeptics know it's here. They're just maybe trying to boost their profits by pretending it isn't, especially in the fossil fuel industry. But I did hope to raise in the reader's mind something about the three elements of the past, present, and future. We live sandwiched between the ghosts of the past and the ghosts of the future. We know something about the ghosts of the past. We know very little about the ghosts of the future. We can only speculate. We feel like we're, you know, self-evidently alive to ourselves. We're at history's summit looking back. But of course, we know in our hearts that soon we will be the ghosts and the future will look with some puzzlement back at us. So I try to construct this novel so that the past, present, and future are kind of braided together, so you get a sense of them all running simultaneously. And the other hope I got is just to maybe have people ask themselves, well, what do we owe the future? Do we have moral responsibilities towards the future? And how will the future feel about us? Will they envy us? Will they despair of us? Will they be furious with us? will they want to join us? As indeed Tom Metcalfe, who looks back on us now, and for all the disastrous mistakes we're making, thinks of us as a very energetic, wild, crazy, inventive civilization, putting a golden telescope a million miles out in space, but, you know, flying 10,000 miles for a week's holiday. Crazy, deranged, even. And that time element and the limits of what we can know, I suppose, is the other thought I'd like to put in the reader's mind. But, as I said before, giving pleasure, arousing curiosity, remains my central aim, as it has done all my life.
Well, the book is What We Can Know. Ian McEwan, thank you so much for joining us today.
A real pleasure, Beth.
What We Can Know by Ian McEwan was published by Knopf. And now, book critic Suzanne Perez talks about a page-turner of a mystery that's modeled on the early years of Saturday Night Live.
The new novel from writing partners Lee Kelly and Jennifer Thorne opens with a decades-long cold case. Comedian Lily Martin has been dead 40 years, and nobody knows exactly what happened. Martin was a rising star on a late-night comedy sketch show called The Midnight Show. She disappeared after a Valentine's Day episode in the show's volatile third season, and evidence shows that she either jumped or was pushed from the Williamsburg Bridge. Telling the story in modern times is journalist Madeline Cohen, who pitches a story to Rolling Stone to honor Martin's life and legacy and to investigate a comedy industry that she says categorizes, commodifies, dismisses, and discards funny women. What unfolds after that is a collection of transcripts from Cohen's interviews with surviving cast members, producers, and friends, and other documents that set the story and thoughtfully advance the plot. It lays bare the ultra-competitive, hard-partying world of New York City comedy in the 1980s, and the whirlwind early days of a show that clearly is modeled on Saturday Night Live. The Midnight Show is a slow-burn mystery with an oral history format that reads like an episode of VH1's Behind the Music. Fans of Taylor Jenkins Reid's Daisy Jones and the Six or Lane Fargo's The Favorites will appreciate the ensemble narrative, which plays especially well on audio. At its heart, though, the novel is a study in female friendship and feminism. Lillian Martin represents so many women who were discounted, overlooked, and abused by industries that men commanded and continue to dominate, including comedy and show business. The authors describe a time when female comics were quickly stereotyped as the slut or the Rapunzel, and backstage episodes that eventually led to the avalanche of testimony that ushered in the Me Too movement. Throughout the novel, journalist Cohen challenges Martin's female friends and co-stars over what she sees as their lack of agency in the 1980s, and they push back with harsh lessons on the realities of that earlier age. The Midnight Show is an addictive novel that will keep you reading or listening until its surprising and satisfying finish. For Marginalia, I'm Suzanne Perez.
The Midnight Show by Lee Kelly and Jennifer Thorne was published by Crown. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Lou Ann Stevens. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.